Florida opens back up for business today. Well, good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a closer look at all of the workplace issues around reopening the state. What are your questions and thoughts about going back to work in your office, for example? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we'll share one local family story of trying desperately but failing to file for unemployment. Why is the state system still so messed up? But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis. By the numbers, statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports 36,078 cases and 1,379 deaths. Here in our area, there are now 1,736 reported cases of coronavirus and 52 deaths. And even though the death toll continues to climb, Florida is opening back up today in what's being called a phased reopening for business. Under Governor Ron DeSantis's plan, Florida's restaurants and retail stores will be allowed to reopen today at 25% capacity if local governments allow. That includes big malls like the St. John's Town Center and the Avenues Mall. Hospitals and surgical centers statewide can restart non-essential elective procedures today. Beaches are mostly open around the state, too. Some other businesses, though, like gyms, movie theaters, and salons, will remain closed for the time being. Now, both business owners and employees have so many questions about this change. They want to know how this is going to work. They're worried, too, about how to manage social distancing in their stores, liability issues, and so much more. So many questions as we start this new phase today. Jacksonville attorney Tyler White is a principal with Jackson Lewis. They specialize in employment issues, and he's on the line to answer all of your questions. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. And thank you so much for being with us. Here's our question to callers. As Florida opens back up for business today, what are your thoughts, comments, concerns about going into a business, how things will go at your workplace? Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails, we're already getting them. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open too. So, Tyler, many businesses today will open their doors to customers, but at greatly reduced capacity. First off, the top of your head, what's the biggest issue these businesses are looking at as they gingerly edge back into dealing with the public today?
Well, Melissa, return to work is so much more than those three simple words at this point. At our firm, Jackson Lewis, we've started to refer to this upcoming time as reopening and reimagining the workplace. And under the new normal, employers are really going to have to be open to new ways to work and to conduct business. And certainly, I think more than anyone, that includes restaurants and retail. The first thing that I think many employers that have retail or restaurant businesses are looking at is safety. That's safety first, but I think the next thing they look at under this new phased opening is financial viability. And they really have to determine whether or not operating at 25% capacity, including all of the things that they're going to have to do to operate safely, does that make financial sense for them, particularly if it means potentially being a place where COVID-19 ends up being found to spread?
Right. And so some restaurants are saying, you know what, we're just not going to have sit-down diners. Many establishments are going to approach this in their own individual ways. Isn't that right? Because the federal government, OSHA, for example, they're not really providing blanket uniform guidelines for business, are they?
They're not. And, you know, I think that one of the ways that businesses like restaurants can deal with this is to try to look for more local guidance. Restaurant associations, local restaurant associations, national restaurant associations, because I think they need to understand what is everyone else doing. You know, I think there needs to be a line of communication among the restaurants so that there is a more uniform practice, because you're right, there really is no federal, state, or local mandate as far as guidance on wearing masks or wearing gloves or how to disinfect. I mean, certainly there are recommendations by OSHA on in their general workplace recommendations. But I think it's something that's going to take a little bit more time to develop, unfortunately.
Here at WJCT, you know, we are wearing masks when we're in the common areas of the building. There is a greatly reduced workforce in the building right now, just a few of us. That is expected to change, though, over the month. More and more people will probably slowly start coming back in. And so when you talk to employers who are trying to figure out how to accommodate their employees, what are you hearing? Some employees might be called back into work, but they don't necessarily want to go back in. They want to continue working from home if they can.
Yeah, I think most employers are sensitive to the safety issues that are attendant to this pandemic. And I think many of them, first and foremost, do care about their employees' safety. And so I think the first approach to reopening, for example, offices, is really employers to reach out to the employees and ask those who want to come back into the office, you know, whether or not they wish to do so. And the people who want to stay home and are potentially continuing to telework or, you know, work remotely, many employers are taking the position that, look, it's still been a pretty short time period that we've been closed. I know it may seem like forever. It seems like years at this point. But they are taking a cautious approach to reopening offices when, you know, essentially their business hopefully has been able to survive this while it's going on.
Tell us, if you could, about a piece of legislation. It's called the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And it does lay out some provisions for companies of less than 500 people. Is that right?
That's correct. And there's a potential exemption for employers with fewer than 50 employees where it might not apply. But essentially, it creates two key provisions for those employers with fewer than 500 employees. One is an emergency paid sick leave provision, which essentially provides employees with 80 hours of emergency paid sick leave related to COVID-19 issues. The other thing is an additional 12 weeks of leave paid at two-thirds of the employee's regular rate for a cap of up to $10,000 if the employee needs to be at home with a child whose school or place of care is closed. And I think the place of care part is the interesting part, because I think schools are, you know, even though we're doing virtual schools right now, those are going to end soon. And the question is, you know, are there going to be daycares? Are there going to be summer camps? I'm thinking probably not. So I think that additional 12 weeks of paid leave could become applicable.
That's a huge issue, isn't it, for so many people out there, Tyler? If they're going back to work this week, we still got a month of school. And if you can't find childcare, you're kind of stuck. People have been working from home, trying to homeschool their kids at the same time. This is a huge employment issue right now.
That's right. And I think, you know, there's a possibility that I don't know this for a fact, but I think we're going to continue to see legislation addressing, you know, this issue, if particularly if infection rates continue to rise.
And, you know, as we go back into work this week, Tyler, in Florida, we've followed the progression of this pandemic in the state quite closely. The governor and others have pointed out we've averted the worst here in Florida. Hospitals are not being overrun with patients. That is what's behind the governor's decision to at least partially reopen today. People are very anxious to start earning money again if they've had to close their business, and that's certainly understandable. That said, public health experts are warning that this virus is still with us. They have questioned whether it's time to go back to this opening for business. They've called to keep social distancing and other measures in place through May and even June. And they're warning that there may be a second wave of this virus. What are your thoughts about that and how that opens up liability concerns for companies?
Well, I think it's certainly true that the virus has not gone away. The virus itself probably has not subsided. You know, we have, I think, started to flatten the curve through the measures that we've all taken in staying at home. But I think it's important to note that a potential second wave could come. And that's one of the things we discuss with employers frequently. And we have to, as employers, prepare for that potential second wave by continuing to enhance and improve remote work capabilities where that's possible, by cross-training employees, by engaging in efforts to disinfect, you know, the work environment, and essentially changing the work environment by expanding products and services that don't require customer on-site presence. But, you know, that's not easy because that is changing an entire business model. But I really think that things are not just going to go back to normal in the middle of the summer because it's very hot and that just necessarily kills the virus. And even if it does, I think we all, nationwide at least, run a risk of this happening again during the colder months.
All right, let's go. Sure. Let's go to some calls now for Attorney Tyler White. He specializes in employment issues at Jackson Lewis in Jacksonville here. What are your thoughts about the workplace as Florida opens back up for business today at reduced capacity? Will you go into a restaurant or a retail store? Do you own a business? Do you have questions about how you're going to conduct business right now? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Linda is in Mandarin. Hello, Linda.
Good morning. I wanted to ask about the question of liability if we do contact tracing and find out it originated at a restaurant. I try to support a local restaurant once a week. I went to a food truck. I left on Friday because they had 20 people. Only one person had on a mask. They were bunched up together. I went to a well-known establishment on Saturday for takeout. They had no mask except for one employee, no gloves, and they weren't sanitizing in between counter takeout orders. So I love them, but I won't be going back because I feel like it was cavalier. There's no standard. And so what happens if there is an outbreak and contact tracers trace it back to a restaurant? It's not really tight because it's optional for them to wear face masks and gloves.
Sure. Thanks for that question. Yeah, Tyler, that's a common question we're hearing.
Sure. And I think it's a valid question because these are the issues that are going to be associated with the reopening of, in particular, restaurants. And I think there's a very real possibility that, you know, there's been talk about ventilation systems inside, you know, businesses and restaurants potentially carrying the virus. And if it is traced back to, you know, a business, I think that certainly, I don't know the exact answer as far as, you know, potential liability, but your insurance carrier as an employer would probably advise you, you know, on that measure. But I do think I could see potential claims associated with that if there is something that is looked at as to whether or not this particular restaurant did take the precautions necessary to, you know, combat this virus.
Here's an email from Sherry. My workplace had a webinar with their legal counsel and even state representatives. They're going to wait until May 5th because they say they need more clarification to ensure they provide a safe workplace. They're going to roll us back in based on circumstances. I have asthma, so I got a reprieve of 2 more weeks to work from home, she says. I think that gives you an example, doesn't it, Tyler, of how business owners are trying to accommodate a whole array of different concerns with different employees, different circumstances. There's no one-size-fits-all probably for each business.
That's right. It's not only industry-specific, but I think it's also you know, business specific. So, for example, I listened to your Wednesday show and heard from some restaurant owners that basically said, look, you know, we don't have a big dining room and 25% capacity doesn't really do much for us, essentially. And we also have...
They can't make money. They probably can't make money that way, right?
They probably can't make enough, depending on the size of their dining room, to justify opening from a financial viability standpoint, much less. Think about the lines that I think may form at some popular restaurants, maybe some popular restaurants that are relatively small. And how do those lines look? And do you have to hire extra employees to make sure that people are distancing outside in those lines? I think that, you know, the stopping people from coming into your restaurant does create other problems outside the restaurant that are going to need to be dealt with. And I think that's one of the things that I think restaurants in particular, but retail too, I think will experience, because think about the St. John's Town Center reopening, for example. Mm-hmm. There are a number of locations at the St. John's Town Center that have relatively small stores. And so, you know, what does 25% capacity look for them? Well, it's only a few people. That may be fine on Monday at, you know, 11 a.m., but what does that look like on Saturday when people, you know, are starting to get out and they do want to go into stores? I think there's going to be lines that form. Where do those lines go? Do they go out into the driveway there? Do they creep around to the next store? I think, you know, this kind of management is going to be very difficult. That's why I do think that a number of employers, both retail and restaurants, are being cautious and probably delaying opening. Just because you see that these malls are opening today does not mean that all of these businesses, particularly national retailers, national restaurants, have taken the approach to go ahead and
reopen. Right. You know, and other states have mandated mask wearing in businesses, but then they've walked it back. Oklahoma, Ohio are two states where people were initially told you got to wear a mask if you go into a place of business. Then they pulled back on that because there was so much pushback, you know. But the truth of the matter is that wearing masks is one of the proven ways we have to prevent the spread of the virus if there are people congregating in moderate to large groups. And we don't have any kind of mandate like that here in Florida. So if there are large crowds at the St. John's Town Center, for example, you have to assume that that's going to spread the virus more because there people will not necessarily all be wearing masks. They will not necessarily all be social distancing.
That's correct. And I think one of the things that seems to be lost on some folks about wearing a mask, I understand it's uncomfortable. It's, you know, a little unsightly. You can only see a person's eyes. But at the same time, I think what people need to understand is wearing a mask is not so you don't get the virus. It's so that you don't potentially spread it. And you may not have it, and that's okay. But the more people that wear masks means the more, or I'm sorry, the less spread that could potentially happen. But, you know, masks are definitely on everyone's list to be considering from a retail and a restaurant perspective. But I think that I have not seen any, you know, federal, state, local mandates regarding masks here in Florida. And I have not even really seen any employers that are mandating it. Although I'm sure there are some restaurants that have, you know, essentially have some policies that say, look, if you're preparing food, you're going to be wearing gloves and you're certainly going to be wearing a mask at this time.
It's 549-2937 to join us as we talk about Florida opening back up for business. Let's go to some tweets, emails. Here's a tweet from a listener. They can open things, but I don't feel safe about going anywhere. We can't trust federal or state leaders to put our interests first. And everyone I know is flat broke, so this isn't looking promising, he says. Yeah, that brings up another point, Tyler. Do people have money to spend in businesses right now? Here is a tweet from a listener. Will restaurants be required to inform the public if an employee tests positive for COVID? They aren't required to do so for hepatitis A. What about that?
I think the general guidance is that employers should be reporting cases of COVID to the local health department. And look, I think the fact is that they should probably close down if that's the case, and probably quarantine, disinfect for a certain period of time. But I think the local health department will provide guidance there.
Okay. Here's an email from a listener. Except for blatant disregard of safety rules, businesses must be accepted by the government from liability, or we'll have a lawyer's bonanza in frivolous lawsuits. Will there be any kind of protection for business coming out of this pandemic?
There's been some discussion in the legislature federally about that. I think that, I believe it's Mitch McConnell, or was it Lindsey Graham, who was talking about it recently, that there needs to be some kind of protection for employers so that there are not a run of lawsuits associated with this. But I think at the end of the day, even if that does happen, I think we're going to see waves of lawsuits associated with this. And it could be all kinds.
Wow. So another thing to brace for. 549-2937, Nicole in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Nicole. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. So I just have a question. So I always hear a lot of talk about everyone else, but I don't hear anything about the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just asking simply because I know a lot of people in the military, friends and stuff, that have been tested, and they're being required to go to work with people who have been tested. And, like, I don't hear anything about the military on the radio.
No, I'm glad you brought that up. We have a large military community here, and we need to talk about how this is going to work on our military bases here in Jacksonville. So, Nicole, I really appreciate that call. Tyler, different rules usually on bases, but what do you know about that? How will this affect our large military community as they're called back to Mayport, NAS Jax? What about that?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I'll be honest, I've not dealt with that very much, but I think the same sort of testing rules will apply. And I think if there is someone with a confirmed positive, they will undergo the same measures, which are quarantined for at least 14 days while they recover. And I think it also applies if they have someone in their household who has tested positive for COVID.
And I'm trying to Google this as you talk, because that's such an important question from that listener. Apparently, individual bases are sharing their case numbers with the federal government, with the Pentagon. And the Pentagon, I guess, has not been that transparent with revealing these numbers to other reporting agencies. I'm just now starting to look at this. But this definitely requires more investigation, whether or not we're getting full transparency, whether the military employees know what the caseload is like on base. It looks like we need to look at that a little further. We might not be getting updated information from the Pentagon on this.
Sure.
Okay. And, you know, what are your final thoughts, Tyler, for people out there? Everybody's got their own unique situation. Businesses have their own unique needs and concerns. But this is a big day for Florida, as after weeks and weeks of stay at home, we're opening back up for business. What are your final thoughts for people out there as we navigate this?
People should practice patience. Employers should practice patience. This is going to be a different experience than what you are used to. Let's take retail, for example. Ever since online sales have grown, the way brick and mortar retail fought back against that was to suggest that the in-store experience was better than just pointing and clicking on your computer, despite the fact that it was inherently less convenient to get in your car and drive to a store and fight the crowd. But now, if the experience puts you at risk, in addition to the inconvenience, retailers have to figure out how to create a safe experience that makes the trip not only worth the inconvenience, but worth the risk as well. And I think that applies to restaurants, too.
All right. And everyone, keep emailing us your experiences and thoughts about this issue. We'll continue to cover it. It's First Coast Connect at WJCT.org to communicate with us. And I want to thank you so much, Tyler, for your insights as we begin this new phase here in Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
He's Jacksonville attorney Tyler White, a principal with Jackson Lewis, specializing in employment issues. And he joined us by phone, and much more still ahead. Later in the hour, we're going to tell you how you can support Giving Tuesday this week, helping nonprofits on the front lines of this pandemic. That's later. But up next,
we can't get any guidance. You cannot get a hold of. I don't know who the lucky winners are each day that are actually getting through, but it hasn't been us for almost 3 weeks. And we start first thing in the morning and call all day.
The absolute nightmare Florida residents are facing right now in trying to access unemployment benefits. We'll hear one local family's ordeal. That's next.
Introducing the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT, offering music lovers a variety of ways to enjoy favorite artists and discover new genres. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
Public radio is where you turn for critical information and updates about the coronavirus pandemic. But we also make sure to bring you moments of beauty and peace.
And Hirata said one thing was certain. The tree would still bloom. He pointed to small red buds. They're starting, he said, just a few days away.
Help us bring you these moments. Make your Giving Tuesday Now gift to this station.
Text the word GIVE 899 to 44321, and thank you.
Welcome back. Well, tens of thousands of Florida residents who have been thrown out of work in this pandemic are still desperately trying to file for unemployment. They report a website that doesn't process claims, and they can't get through on phone lines to reach anyone either, even though they call all day and night. This, even though thousands of new workers are staffing a call center to try to fix the issues and fix the website. Brandy Summers of Jacksonville and her son Jeremiah are two such people. They were recently furloughed from an aviation firm at Cecil Field. Here's their story. Brandy Summers, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So like so many other people around Florida, you are currently unemployed and having trouble accessing unemployment. What's the latest with your situation? Tell me what's going on in your household.
Well, in my household, it's both me and my son were furloughed from our company on the same day about 3 weeks ago.
What company is that?
Am I allowed to say that?
Sure.
It's FlightStar Aircraft Services.
Okay.
It's out at Cecil Field.
Mm-hmm. So you're furloughed 3 weeks ago. Then what?
Right, correct. You know, that day we looked to apply for unemployment, and it said that any new applicant who had not received benefits before in Florida used this site as opposed to the Connect site, which is, I guess, their old whatever. So we did. It had a lot of issues, and we put in the information, but I knew it wasn't complete because it didn't ask for things like how to pay you, just general information that unemployment would ask. You know, it didn't give you a next step. It didn't say, we'll contact you or you contact us or anything. It just stopped asking questions. And then for until this last weekend, if you looked at it, it said resolved, completed. We thought we hadn't done it right, so we did a second one. It did the same thing, resolved, completed. And over this weekend, I guess while they were down doing maintenance, it changed to pending, submitted. Hmm. And now we can't see a lot of the information we put in.
Hmm.
So we did a third one, which I'm a little questioning whether we should have done that or not because I'm afraid we might be messing it up. But we're also afraid we're going to be losing our out on the benefits if we're not making sure something's in there up to date. We can't get any guidance. You cannot get a hold of, I don't know who the lucky winners are each day that are actually getting through, but it hasn't been us for almost 3 weeks. And we start first thing in the morning and call all day. And we can't even get put on hold.
Wow.
So,
so you don't know whether you are eligible to receive the benefits or not. Is that right?
Well, correct. I mean, I assume that we are. You know, we were employed tax-paying citizens for the last 9 years here in Florida. So I assume that we are. But no, we don't. We don't know anything. We don't know what the status is. We've heard varying stories on whether they're going to retroactivate it or not. They won't confirm it. We've gotten a hold of a couple people by calling not that number, but the PIN number, or I once got a hold of somebody by calling the line that's for, like, handicapped people. We're getting conflicting information from people, and mostly they say they don't know.
Yeah.
They're just calling the main number that nobody answers.
Okay.
You know, it just disconnects you.
Okay, so as you are left in limbo, what is your financial picture like right now?
I'm going into credit card debt. I consider myself probably one of the luckier ones that I have that to do, but it's scaring the bejesus out of me, to be honest, because both of us lost our income at the same time. It's me, my son, his wife, and three children. He just had a baby when this happened. So he'd already been off on unpaid leave for paternity leave for a couple weeks right when this happened. we do have a home, and but I'm equating it to when I got told I had cancer a couple years ago. That scared the heck out of me. You know, the unknown, the anxiety levels, it's really on par with that, not to belittle the cancer. I know I'm not going to die, but I am concerned about medical coverage. You know, I've got a pre-existing condition. I don't know what's going to go on with that. And I can't get any unemployment. I don't know how to make a plan. I don't know what to do. So there's a lot of uncertainty.
Sure. And I'm sorry about the cancer diagnosis. Are you doing better now?
I'm in remission from leukemia. They said it was almost kind of like a miracle. But so, yes, I'm very, very blessed there. And, you know, we bought this house thinking they were going to grow up in it. And now I'm wondering if they're ever even going to remember living in it.
Mm. You know, I'm so sorry to hear.
I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry to hear this. And, you know, we're following this closely because 40% of the people who've applied for unemployment in Florida are being told now that they're ineligible to get it, even though, as you said, they have paid into the system. They're Florida residents. Everyone should be eligible, theoretically. Right. And so, and you don't even have an answer yet as to whether you're going to get the money or not, which is
correct.
Also terrible.
And we're not even sure if it's been submitted correctly. You know, it's been a full-time job just trying to figure this out since this happened. So, you know, let alone looking around to see what might be out there for work. They told us that the new system they set up, I don't know where all the money is going that they say they put into it, but they say the new system doesn't talk to the old system. So it's basically like all the information, all these new applicants are putting in, which are people who've never gotten unemployment before, which means they've been working.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that it's just like in some kind of a bubble and they have not, it's not in their Connect system. So it's not even really being processed.
Let me ask you one last question. When do you expect your company to call you and your son back to work?
Well, to be honest, I don't know if they will. You know, we've been there 9 years. We moved here for this job a little over nine years ago, but it was bought out. And the way that they cut people wasn't like seniority or anything. So I'm not really sure. I don't have a lot of confidence we're going to be called back. And they definitely said it won't be anytime soon. They've lost a lot of business. Major customers pulled out, you know, being aviation. And the outlook on aviation, you know, it's not going to come booming back, you know, in a few weeks. So I really don't know.
Wow. I'm so sorry you're going through this. And I want to thank you for sharing your story. I wish there was more I could do. What I can promise you is that we will continue highlighting this issue because it is so critical for so many people in this state.
It is.
So Brandy Summers, Brandy, I want to thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I appreciate that you're putting a spotlight on this because it definitely needs to be spotlighted.
Well, communities of color have been especially hit hard by this pandemic. At Jacksonville's Mayo Clinic, a new Hispanic outreach project is underway. And we want to share that right now as we welcome on the line Dr. Richard White of Mayo Clinic. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for being with us. Also joining us by phone, Pastor Angel Santiago of Iglesia Shiloh Orange Park. Pastor Santiago, good to have you.
Good morning to everyone.
Thank you so much both for being with us. Dr. White, let's start with you. We had actually booked this segment before the pandemic hit, so there's a little bit of a change in what we're going to talk about. But first, if you could, tell us about this new HOPE 2 project at Mayo, and that stands for Hispanic Outreach and Patient Engagement.
Sure, Melissa. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to talk about the work that we're doing at Mayo Clinic. So our Center for Health Equity and Community Engaged Research, we received some funding from the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute back in October of 2018. And we, our team had previously had a relationship with some Hispanic faith leaders in the community, including Pastor Santiago. And we have been meeting on a regular basis and really just brainstorming about ways that we could collaborate to try and address some of the health concerns of our community. When we received the funding, we formulated the advisory board that you just mentioned and began to really get to work. And we're planning a community-wide health conference that we are calling Jack Saludable, as you mentioned, which was scheduled to take place on May 16th. But because of the pandemic, unfortunately, we've had to postpone.
Right. So that, are you going to wait until later this year to have it, or will you do a virtual event?
So we actually have postponed it into July 25th, and we're looking to transition the whole event. We're hoping that we'd be able to meet in person still, but it looks like we're going to need to transition the event to an online format, which we're actually really excited about.
Right, and we're seeing that with so many events, and I've even participated in a couple that were supposed to be in person but ended up being by Zoom or WebEx. And as we navigate this whole new world, you're also doing some very traditional outreach, and that includes with the faith community. So, Pastor Santiago, Mayo Clinic is working with dozens of local churches in the Hispanic community. How is this working? How is your congregation part of this?
So we have reached out to several churches. One thing we have to put out front is that most of the Hispanic churches are in the Hispanic community. And we have the voice and the arm to reach those in the need for equity in the medical field. So our churches are being benefited by having a voice that sometimes they don't have.
There are structural barriers that people of color often have to navigate to access equitable health care. And this is something that you're helping with, too. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, one of the barriers that we also have is our language. So there's a lot of Hispanics that are here, especially in the elder community, that do not speak English. And sometimes that becomes a barrier because, the way the patient and doctor communicate sometimes is not understood even through a translator. So we're trying to research these disparities and try to accommodate the Hispanic community.
And Dr. White, this event that you've postponed to July was going to talk about a host of health topics like dementia, breast cancer, diabetes, mental health. But also now you need to talk about how Latinx people are being adversely affected by COVID-19. What are you seeing on that front at Mayo Clinic? What are the concerns there?
Yeah, it's a great question, Melissa, and I'm glad that you mentioned that because when the COVID-19 pandemic occurred, you know, it was interesting. Our advisory board had met 2 days before the governor announced the shelter stay-in order. And so we realized early on that we were really going to need to pivot. One of the components that we were planning for our community-wide health conference was to focus on mental health. And with the pandemic, obviously, the Hispanic community, there's over almost 80,000 Hispanics in Northeast Florida, and as Pastor Santiago mentioned, many of them struggle with English or English learners. And so we knew that as we looked at the information that was being disseminated in the community, if you look on our Department of Health website, there is a lot of, the CDC website, there is a lot of information that is available in Spanish. But one of the challenges that we know that faces our Hispanic community is that many times people, even though they may speak or read Spanish, may have a lower level of health literacy. And oftentimes when information, particularly medical terminology, is put in Spanish, it's still a challenge for people with challenges of health literacy to be able to know how to navigate that information, particularly assimilate that information and individualize it for their care and make appropriate healthcare decisions. So our group, along with Pastor Santiago and our other community partners that we've been working with, really decided that we would try to pivot our focus and really try to do our part in helping to educate our Hispanic community about the pandemic, about the virus, specifically things that they could do to prevent themselves being exposed, keeping themselves safe, and where particularly they could go if they did develop symptoms or if they needed testing.
Okay, so Pastor Santiago, how is that effort going, talking about people wearing masks, social distancing, hand washing, and all of the things we're being told to do?
One of the great things that we have accomplished that we have infiltrated, if you can say that, into the social media. We have a web page and we have a Facebook page. where information is being placed in Spanish and resources are being made available where the Hispanic community can go and find these resources and be helpful to them. There's a lot of information that Dr. White and other people have uploaded to the webpage, and they have it's just been something that's been needed, and now it's available.
Okay. And Dr. White, going beyond this pandemic, how will this outreach effort continue? Certainly, we don't have as large a Hispanic population in North Florida as what you see in Central or South Florida, but it's growing. So I would assume this effort will only grow over time.
Yeah, Melissa, that's certainly our hope. One of the things that we know, some of the challenges that Hispanics in Northeast Florida face compared to maybe a Hispanic community member that maybe lives in Orlando or further south, certainly in Miami, is that our infrastructure for particularly helping patients to navigate our often complex healthcare system, for someone who may be a limited English proficient individual, there's some challenges there. Pastor Santiago already mentioned oftentimes accessing care could be a challenge if you don't speak English well. So we certainly hope that our work can continue. We know that even after the pandemic, all the dust settles, that there's going to be some mental health concerns, economic concerns that we're really hopeful that our team will continue to be able to address, because those things oftentimes have health implications attached with them. And we're just really thankful for all of our community partners that have come alongside us, and we certainly hope that our message will continue to grow even beyond the Jack Saludable event. We're really hoping to create a movement, Jack Saludable, within our Hispanic community in Northeast Florida, where people can really feel that they have a place where they can go and get accurate guidance on how to navigate our complex healthcare system.
And that's Jack Saludable. Can people find that online and register for this conference, which, as you said, it will now be in July, not May?
That is correct. People can go to www.jacksaludable.com.
Okay. Check that out. And I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Dr. Richard White on the line from Mayo Clinic and Pastor Angel Santiago of Iglesias Shiloh Orange Park, as we look at Mayo Clinic's outreach to the North Florida Hispanic community. Guys, thanks so much, and keep in touch.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Thank you.
In a moment, how you can help nonprofits on the front lines of the pandemic this week in a brand new Giving Tuesday. It's tomorrow. Find out all about it after this. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. And by the way, you can give to WJCT on this Giving Tuesday, which is tomorrow. Just go to WJCT.org to donate. We'll be right back.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The personal toll the coronavirus is taking on healthcare workers is immense. A Chicago nurse who has lost patients back to back tells us about the only thing she can do for them at the end.
Hold their hand and wait for the monitors to turn off and sort of be gentle and as caring as you can.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Many native Floridians proudly refer to themselves as Crackers. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will explore cracker culture and the cattle industry that it produced. We'll discuss Frederick Remington's take on cracker cowmen and talk about an attempt to create a film studio on Whedon Island. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Millions of Americans are out of work and struggling to pay rent. Some landlords are being flexible. Still, it's a terrible time to be a tenant.
I wouldn't want to get backtracked in my rent and then get evicted when all of this is over because I won't be able to pay my back pay.
Stories from across America as a new housing crisis starts to unfold. What can be done to stop it? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
There are many ways that you can give in this moment. You can sew masks. You can bring groceries to a neighbor. Or help your neighbors stay informed and connected by giving now to this station. Here's how.
Donate to WJCT today. Go to wjct.org/radio and thank you.
Welcome back. Well, did you know tomorrow is Giving Tuesday? Yeah, the concept of Giving Tuesday has really taken off in the last few years, giving nonprofits a real boost to their funding. Last year's Giving Tuesday campaign pulled in more than $500 million for U.S. nonprofits. Now, due to the pandemic, this year's Giving Tuesday campaign has added an extra Tuesday for tomorrow to help out organizations working to maintain funding during this challenging time. I learned more about Giving Tuesday from Mary Qureshi, president of the Jesse Paul Ball DuPont Fund here in Jacksonville. Let's listen.
Mari, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
And with this pandemic, people have so many concerns and questions and worries. We want to cut through that noise for a minute and talk about the importance of Giving Tuesday on Tuesday, May 5th. Can you talk a little bit about this day and why it matters?
Absolutely. So May 5th is a new giving opportunity. It's called Giving Tuesday Now, and it's associated with a Giving Tuesday that we might be more familiar with, which happens on the first Tuesday after Thanksgiving. But it was brought together by the Giving Tuesday folks in order to give nonprofits an opportunity to rally together to highlight the important work that they do, especially in the context of this pandemic. So it's a special 2020 edition of Giving Tuesday.
Sure. And obviously, we have gotten used to the initial Giving Tuesday at the holidays in supporting a nonprofit of our choice, giving what we can. Now we're in a whole new situation. What are nonprofits facing during COVID-19, and how have their operations changed?
Well, I mean, like everybody else, their entire modalities have been turned upside down, right? To the extent that nonprofits, work with clients directly, and whether it is distributing food or delivering mental health services or even just providing a safe place for teens and youth. With social distancing, all of those things are incredibly difficult to do. So the nonprofits, for instance, that are delivering mental health services have had to pivot and deliver their services via their smartphones or through Zoom. On the other side, nonprofits are usually raise money through events and gala dinners. None of that is possible in the context of social distancing. So they've really had to, one, figure out new ways of reaching their clients and also new ways of reaching their supporters. And much of that is digital.
Yeah.
Which is why Giving Tuesday Now is so important.
So important. And you know a lot about this. Your current role, of course, is president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, but you are also the co-founder of Global Giving. That is the world's first and largest global crowdfunding platform. So how should Florida nonprofits be mobilizing digitally right now around Giving Tuesday? What should they be doing?
So first and foremost, they should start observing how nonprofits have leveraged, if they are new to Giving Tuesday. Many of them are not new to Giving Tuesday, so for them it's just a question of pulling out the playbook and updating it. But if you're new, you should start following Giving Tuesday on social media. Following Giving Tuesday Now, there's a separate Twitter handle for Giving Tuesday Now. Looking at how some other organizations leverage the occasion and really start defining what are the messages you want to get out both to your supporters and your clients through your social media presence. Now, I know this sounds potentially like a big barrier to entry for some nonprofits, but the thing about digital is that it doesn't actually take a huge amount of cash. You know, establishing an Instagram account, establishing a Twitter account, all of these are free. And among, I'm sure, your donors and supporters and volunteers are some pretty social media savvy people. If you reach out to them and say, hey, we'd like to start defining our presence online, I'm sure that you will find people who, in fact, are looking for things that they could be doing in this day of social distancing and being cooped up at home.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of opportunities. I think it's just a question of knowing how to take it one step at a time. And I know that from my conversations and participation with work at the Nonprofit Center here in Jacksonville, that there are many nonprofits really interested in this subject.
Sure. Look for the hashtag Giving Tuesday or Giving Tuesday Now, Giving Tuesday Now, and donate where you can. Nonprofits, organize your campaigns. It's a little bit of time left to take advantage of this. And I thank you so much, Mari Qureshi. She's president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund here in Jacksonville. Thanks, Mari.
Thank you.
And a quick reminder, you can donate to WJCT tomorrow or any day, but tomorrow is Giving Tuesday, at WJCT.org. Look for the donate button on the top right of the page. Make a one-time gift or a monthly donation, as we too are essential workers in this pandemic. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Jessica Palumbo runs the newsroom. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you missed anything, find today's podcast at WJCT.org or your favorite podcast platform. We'll connect with you again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Let us know how reopening for business is going out there, too. Talk to you soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.